KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. In an update to the Las Cruces City Council this week, members of the city's police department gave a comprehensive overview of recent crime stats and addressed personnel shortages. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Violent crime within the city of Las Cruces has risen 22% within the last year, according to a new quarterly report from the Las Cruces Police Department. Since 2020, robberies within the city have increased by 61%. LCPD Police Chief Miguel Dominguez says that many of the robberies have centered around personal disputes, with a quarter being drug-related.
Typically, you think robberies and people think of convenience stores and banks being held up, only four involved in establishment. Many of the rest of those are other types of robberies. 45% of those where the victim actually knew the suspects.
While the number of robberies and aggravated assaults have increased, criminal homicides in Las Cruces have fallen 13%. The number of residential burglaries have also decreased this year from 214 reports in 2020 to 159 in 2021. Other areas, such as vehicle burglaries, have risen significantly. A crime Dominguez says increases whenever college is in session.
Auto burglaries jumps off the page at 25%. We know that 63% of these occurred in apartments and residences. We know that there's possibly crews that are working throughout the night, as we'll have 12 or 13 auto burglaries happen on the same street. So we know that there's crews of four or five, often kids, that are going through, and we call it popping doors. They just check to see when the vehicles are left open and the crimes of opportunity, getting whatever they can out of there.
Deputy Chief Paul Brock says the department is employing a multitude of strategies to combat crime, including community policing initiatives and online reporting.
What we're talking about is working hand in hand with our community partnership officers, the community outreach officers. On a normal day-to-day basis, patrol and community outreach are working projects together. They're sharing intel together. They're checking statuses. They're getting information from the intel section, identifying problematic areas, issues that are going on, different crime trends, and then they're working hand in hand with each other in order to find solutions for those crime problems that we're seeing.
Addressing the current personnel shortage is also top of mind for the LCPD. Currently, only 172 commissioned officer positions out of a possible 202 are filled, up from approximately 150 last May. LCPD Sergeant Cody Austin says the LCPD has received over 700 applications, noting he is optimistic the personnel shortage won't last long.
With the incentives that we brought in, we boosted our number above the 700 mark. The incentive significantly increased the number of college applicants. Currently, we're in the polygraph stage of the hiring process, and of the remaining 64% of those applicants do have some type of formal college education as well. So, in short, we're very optimistic about the upcoming academy in January of 2022 by being able to fill the 25 slots, even up to 30 if possible.
Austin says LCPD in-service training efforts go beyond the 677 hours required by the New Mexico Law Enforcement Academy. The 1,081 hours required by the LCPD also includes training elements that address realistic de-escalation and fair and impartial policing. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
The border is now open to vaccinated visitors from Mexico who want to cross into the U.S. for non-essential reasons. KTEP's Angela Cocherica reports.
It was an emotional moment for Gerardo Rosas Reyes. The 61-year-old says he felt chills walking across the international bridge from Juarez to El Paso. All of his siblings live on the U.S. side of the border, and he's been crossing back and forth for 45 years. That all came to an abrupt end in March of 2020 when the U.S. and Mexico imposed pandemic restrictions on non-essential border travel, including visiting relatives and shopping. Rosas Reyes was on his way to see one of his sisters when he stopped to look at some sweatshirts on a sidewalk rack. Alfredo Lopez works at the store. Lopez says the sun is starting to shine now that the customers the store depends on from Mexico are back and just in time for the holiday season. Janet Moreno brought her 3-year-old niece, Chelsea, Christmas shopping.
Juguetes para Navidad.
For toys on the first day the border reopened to non-essential travel. Berenice Treviso rolled a large pink suitcase across the bridge. She was on her way to catch a bus to Colorado Springs.
So happy from I'm going to see my sister. I miss so much her.
Their reunion, just one of many, now that visitors from Mexico can once again cross the border to see relatives. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
New Mexico U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan and El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar are joining border leaders to demand the passage of two new acts that call for oversight of immigration enforcement agencies. Texas Public Radio's Sophia Sanchez has that report.
Weeks after disturbing images surfaced that showed mounted patrol agents using their horses to intimidate immigrants in Del Rio, the new Ellis Island Border Policy Working Group is calling on the Biden administration to pass legislation that holds border security agents more accountable. Escobar says she is working with Lujan and border leaders to provide two new acts that include the voices of border residents.
No one cares more about security than those of us who live on the border, raise our families on the border, and plan on being on the border for the rest of our lives.
Demands within the bills include an independent oversight panel, an ombudsman for border concerns, and annual training reviews.
I'm Sophia Sanchez reporting.
People of color accounted for virtually all population growth in Texas over the past 10 years. But when lawmakers met to redraw the state's congressional maps, they actually created more white-majority districts. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider investigates.
Fort Bend County sits at the heart of Texas's 22nd congressional district. It's home to the state's biggest Asian American population, including large numbers of immigrants. So when the Texas legislature met to redraw congressional maps, many Asian Americans hoped Texas 22 would reflect that. Niloufar Hafizi is an attorney with the Muslim American advocacy group, MGAGE Texas.
Our position has been that given the explosive growth of the around 84% growth of the Asian American population in Fort Bend, those communities should have been kept together.
But that didn't happen. Instead, lawmakers did what's called cracking, splitting the Asian American community among three congressional districts, the Democratic 7th and 9th, both tied to Houston and Harris County, and the Republican 22nd. The part of Fort Bend in the 22nd is now tied to rural Wharton and Matagorda counties to the south and west.
I don't know how to say this in a different way, but it whitens the district.
Texas 22 was a safe Republican congressional seat for decades, reelecting such conservative stalwarts as Tom DeLay and Pete Olson. But in 2018 and 2020, the district became highly competitive. Democrat Sri Preston Kulkarni came close to flipping the seat both times. Hafizi says Republicans made sure that won't happen in 2022.
Our concerns are that it has been redrawn explicitly to keep Troy Neals in office as a Republican.
Craig Goodman agrees. Goodman teaches political science at the University of Houston at Victoria.
Under the old boundaries, you know, this was basically a 50-50 district, Democrat-Republican at the presidential level. With the new boundaries, it shifts the district that it's a plus 16 Republican district at the presidential level.
Goodman says Republicans did the same thing elsewhere.
From Dallas-Fort Worth to the 2nd Congressional District, also in Houston, we're seeing this broader pattern of shoring up these districts that were trending Democratic and figuring out ways to kind of move enough voters around to basically allow Republicans to maintain the status quo.
That suits the 22nd's Republicans just fine. James Pressler is a precinct chair and a former candidate for county tax assessor collector.
You know, in a county that began going Democrat back in 2016 with Hillary Clinton, and then it got worse in 2018, and then in 2020, CD22 is the one thing that we have to be proud of as conservative Republicans.
Other Republicans, like precinct chairman David Vershek, say there's nothing wrong with Texas GOP lawmakers drawing boundaries that benefit them. Vershek notes Democrats have done the same thing.
Illinois had 14 Republicans. They redistricted the 14 Republicans into 7 districts. So, you know, they complain about redistricting in Texas, and at the same time, they turn a blind eye to redistricting in Illinois and other places.
Still, Asian American Democrats like Nabila Mansour argued that Texas 22 is an egregious example. Mansour herself was redrawn out of the 22nd district.
What's actually happened is that even though we've seen the population grow and really been charged by immigrants, those lines, when they were redrawn, have been redrawn in a way such that it's actually diluted our power.
And unless a court overturns the new maps, that power is likely to remain diluted for at least another 10 years. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. On the Health Watch this week, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends people 60 and older without cardiovascular disease should not begin a daily low-dose aspirin regimen to prevent heart attacks and strokes. Dr. Vivian Jones, a family physician with Texas Health Resources, explained why to KERA's Sam Baker.
Aspirin can increase the risk of bleeding, internal bleeding in particular. This bleeding risk also increases with age. So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force felt it appropriate to reconsider and readjust some of those recommendations that had previously been made.
Concern about bleeding is not a new one. I think that contributed to the last set of recommendations we had.
In looking at the recommendations that were made in previous years, the recommendations were a little bit more general. And as time went on, we were able to have more studies to indicate that the risk of bleeding really might outweigh the benefit of cardiovascular effects. And so over time, and with a look at those studies, it was determined that some more information needed to be clarified for the general population.
So then everyone who is taking aspirin then is not necessarily having this problem. They're just what, finding more evidence of bleeding in some people?
That is correct. There are some individuals who should use low-dose aspirin daily. Individuals who are at a higher risk of cardiovascular disease.
Some For of those instance?
Medical conditions like elevated cholesterol or dyslipidemias, high blood pressure, diabetes, being overweight or chronically inactive, even smoking. In those situations, low-dose daily aspirin can decrease the incidence of heart attacks or ischemic strokes. Aspirin is a great drug and it has a lot of great benefit, but it works at molecular level by irreversibly inhibiting a chemical inside of the platelets. And this chemical helps the platelets to adhere to each other and to form clots. We think about clots as a bad thing, but actually clots can be good because they're helping to stop bleeding when we need bleeding to stop. So when you take an aspirin, it inhibits the formation of that aggregation, if you will, of the platelets. And as such, it takes about 10 days for that effect to finally go away. The platelet is unable to generate itself on its own. So we need about 10 days for the body to regenerate new platelets.
Is there any kind of alternative to aspirin that you would use for such people who are at high risk?
Absolutely. Therapeutic lifestyle changes, things like regular physical activity, moderate intense exercise for at least 150 minutes a week, an activity that you enjoy doing, something that will motivate you, and a healthy diet, management of underlying medical conditions, and even adjunctive drug therapies, depending on what your medical conditions are.
So in the meantime, then, what about people who are taking low-dose aspirin daily now to prevent heart events? Should they stop?
In many individuals, there is great benefit. In some individuals, there is risk. And so you have to have an individualized discussion with your primary care doctor in order to determine which level of aspirin therapy, if any at all, you should be using, in addition to what other alternatives are available.
What's the risk of stopping?
You could greatly increase your risk for having that cardiovascular event. If you're already at risk, let's say you have some genetic factors. Let's say you do have some of those medical conditions that we talked about. Let's say you've already had a stroke or a heart attack. You are decreasing the chances for your body to fight it naturally on its own, to be able to decrease the incidence of having another stroke or a heart attack. So it would be a good idea to, instead of stopping immediately, have that conversation with your provider. The last thing that I'd like to say is please, if you haven't done so, it's really important to have a relationship with a trusted healthcare provider. We have concerns surrounding COVID. We are now in flu season, and many individuals are just now beginning to feel more comfortable coming back to their doctors and having face-to-face conversations. It's important to do that. You do not want to feel that you are alone in making decisions regarding your health. And this aspirin changes with the recommendations from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force can seem confusing. And so if you can have a conversation with someone who you know, who knows you, it makes those decision-making efforts that more easy.
Dr. Jones, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
And join us for the Health Watch every Tuesday morning on Morning Edition at 6:45. Commentary now, and some Republicans have spoken out against a ban on firearms at the New Mexico State Capitol building, better known as the Roundhouse. But others say more firearms safety precautions are needed, especially during a time of frequent threats and mass shootings. Thoughts now from commentator Walt Rubel.
Last week, the New Mexico legislature finally passed a bill banning guns in the state capitol building. Now, they need to provide that same common sense protection for local school boards and city councils. The Legislative Council Committee, which includes leaders from both parties and chambers, and meets each month when the legislature's not in session, passed the new rule on an 8-5 vote, with all Republicans in opposition. Past attempts to ban firearms at the Roundhouse through legislation have failed, following contentious committee hearings that always included people providing public input with rifles slung over their shoulders and pistols strapped to their hips. There are places where firearms just shouldn't be part of the process, and they shouldn't be part of free speech, and the Roundhouse is one of them, Senate Majority Leader Peter Wirth of Santa Fe told the Associated Press. I agree, but so is City Hall. In 2018, the Las Cruces City Council had to move a work session to a building other than City Hall in order to have a discussion about guns without having one side armed to the teeth. An earlier meeting to consider a proposed statement in support of a ban on semi-automatic gun sales attracted well-armed opponents who made their presence known both inside the meeting and outside the building. It's an obvious attempt to stifle debate through unspoken threats of violence. And it worked. The city council tabled the issue. Mayor Ken Miyagashima said that while guns are prohibited in all federal buildings and will now also be banned in the Roundhouse, local governments do not have the authority to restrict weapons in their buildings. Senator George Munoz of Gallup said new threats, such as those following the riot at the United States Capitol on January 6th, have forced the legislature to reconsider its traditionally permissive attitude towards guns. It's the way the world is making us do things now, he explained. Has he not seen what's going on at school board meetings all over the country? I moved to New Mexico shortly after the September 11th attacks, when security was being beefed up everywhere. Going through metal detectors and having our bags checked became a way of life anytime we entered into a crowded space. And so, I was slack-jawed the first time I saw a guy with a gun on his hip waltz past the state police officer stationed at the entrance of the Roundhouse. Code of the West, I was told. Republicans argued that carrying weapons in the Roundhouse was a form of free expression, which is true, but it was an expression wrapped in threat. The new rule will allow more people to express their opinions without fear and will ultimately strengthen our democracy at the state level. The same must be done at the local level. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. Wildfires and the loss of aquatic habitats are some of the challenges facing the Rio Grande and its surrounding watersheds. Local experts discussed solutions to those challenges during a recent forum. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
The watersheds of southern Colorado and northern New Mexico provide 50 to 75% of the water found in the Rio Grande. But an increased severity and frequency of wildfires are threatening the area's snowpack and the river itself. New Mexico State University Extension Forest and Fire Specialist Doug Cram says southern latitudes and lower elevations are often more susceptible to a reduction in snowpack after wildfires, leaving unique challenges for the state of New Mexico.
When it's snowing, all this tree canopy intercepts that snow. But if there's a severe wildland fire, those trees would be removed, so you have snow on the ground, but then those trees aren't there to provide shade, so you have an impact from solar radiation. So you have some of these competing factors. As you probably are well aware, we have pretty good documentation of increasing frequency and severity and size of fires really around the world, and certainly here in the Southwest.
Cram says another factor to consider is the amount of charcoal and ash that can blanket parts of New Mexico's snowpack.
Instead of reflecting more light, because it's white, that black would be absorbing more sunlight, and so increase shortwave radiation. You can imagine how that might impact snow.
According to the National Interagency Fire Center, over 10.1 million acres burned nationwide in 2020. In 2019, it was slightly over 4.6 million acres. For New Mexico, a state currently predicted to lose more than 70% of its snowpack by the end of the century, protecting the resource from wildfires is critical. Currently, federal appropriations, such as the $1.58 billion in federal dollars spent on wildfire response in 2019, are largely focused on fire suppression efforts. Cram says increasing management expenditures focusing on the health of the watershed, rather than concentrating largely on suppressing fires as they happen, is a smart investment.
One of our challenges is, here in the Southwest and across the West, is the amount of money we put into our forest management. We have less money spent on management through time and more money spent on suppression. Managing watershed is a better investment. So what we'd like to see here through time, right, is increased expenditures in management and decrease expenditure in suppression.
And wildfires aren't the only danger to the Rio Grande. Kevin Bixby, the executive director of the Southwest Environmental Center, says international water distribution below Elephant Butte leaves nothing for the ecosystem itself.
The federal government filed for water rights for the entire flow of the Rio Grande below Elephant Butte, so every drop in the river is spoken for. And what that means, in a practical way, is that there's no legal obligation to leave any water in the river. And what it also means is that restoration projects, tree plantings, wetlands, in-stream flows, must obtain water rights to support them.
Bixby listed more than 15 native fish species once found in southern New Mexico that are now gone due to the river drying up annually and the loss of aquatic habitat. He says he would like to see the section of the Rio Grande below Elephant Butte re-engineered to help restore the ecosystem.
One possibility is to re-engineer a mini Rio Grande that functions like the old river, but on a smaller scale. And it would require obtaining a share of water for the river itself, and then using that water to releasing it, managing it to mimic the way the river used to flow, in particular the spring floods. If we did that, the river itself could restore slow water habitats.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
In focus on KRWG News this week, in honor of Veterans Day week, KRWG-TV presented the new documentary, A Rendezvous with Destiny. If you missed it, you can watch tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on KRWG-TV or right now on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section at krwg.org. The film is followed by an interview with director Tracy Hunter, and we bring you that conversation right now.
A wonderful documentary, A Rendezvous with Destiny, and I'm pleased to have with us the film director Tracy Hunter. Tracy, I know you have told other stories of our veteran service. Tell me how you came upon this story and decided it was right for a documentary film.
Absolutely. So we had been working with World War II veterans for years, and this story came to us from a gentleman in the Netherlands, Mr. Joost Groen, and he actually wrote a book about these three men. So it was really interesting that somebody from another country had so much interest in our veterans. And he presented this book and told me about the three men, Mr. Dan McBride, Mr. Jim Pee-wee Martin, and Mr. Dick Klein. And after reading the book and talking to the veterans, I just knew this was such a special story that we, as our organization Beyond the Call, really wanted to tell and highlight three of the last World War II Screaming Eagles, which was the Airborne Division, and all three of these men were in Normandy and Market Garden and the Battle of the Bulge. So it was just, their stories are amazing, you know, from start to finish, and this new experimental division in the military. And they all each had such different experiences, even though they went through the same battles. And so it really was a story that touched our hearts, and the men, we fell in love with them so quick. So
I bet you did. And of course, among those three veterans, you mentioned Dan McBride, who is from Silver City. Tell me about the process of finding the veterans and convincing them to participate. We know that they were in this book, but of course it's one thing to talk to an author and very much another to be talking to a documentary filmmaker with a camera there. A little different process.
Yeah, so Dan was actually my first veteran that we interviewed for this project, and I remember the first phone call with him. I was nervous. I had never talked to him before. Obviously, so much respect for what he had done. And we talked for about an hour. And at the end of the call, I said, well, can we come out and film you? He said, yeah, you seem like a nice lady. So yeah, I'll let you come. So we came out there and spent a weekend with him. And we really tried to make sure that we're not just focused on filming, that we're focused on forming relationships as well with our veterans. So Dan spent the whole weekend with us. He took us out to his friend's ranch, and you know, we were able to meet the friends at his American Legion and just really get to be a part of his life. And since then, we've become such great friends. So it was just so exciting to meet this man who had just, he's 97 now and has spent so much of his life dedicated to our country, and also to the stories of the men who didn't come back. He's really the voice for the ones who were left behind and lost. So it was just absolutely a huge honor to get to spend time with him and become such good friends since.
Well, Tracy, as you know, we are losing so many of our World War II veterans, so time is of the essence to preserve these stories. Tell me about that as a driver for you.
That is a huge drive for us, and it's one that is just a daily heartbreak, because the reality is we cannot get to every single veteran before this generation is gone, but we can do our best, and it takes a global effort. There's so many great veteran organizations that are doing similar work. We're making sure these guys and gals are remembered and honored. And so for us, you know, we know when we make that phone call and say, can we come interview you? Sometimes 2 weeks after the interview, we've lost these veterans. And so we know the value of these stories. And once they're gone, the stories are gone, the history is gone with them. And so it is so crucial to make sure that we're preserving these stories as much as possible while we still have the generation left.
I know your work is part of a nonprofit, Beyond the Call. Tell me about that and how it came to be.
Yes, so Beyond the Call is our nonprofit, and it's run by three amazing women who all have military backgrounds. And we travel around and interview World War II veterans and document their stories. And the way it came about, my grandfather was in World War II and was a POW. And then I also grew up an Army brat. My dad served for 22 plus years in the Army. And so the military was just something that was really important to me, and making sure the stories were told. And my grandfather had a really hard time coming home from the war. You know, I don't think he had a lot of places to talk about it, or he just kind of got back to work, got a family, and did his job. He stayed in the military. But it was something that I said, you know, I would love for a place for these people to have a safe place to share these stories, and to know that what they did mattered. It matters to our generation. It will matter to generations to come, because we're still enjoying the liberties and freedoms that that generation gave us to this day. And so it was something that myself and the other two women, Elizabeth Suter and Ashley Andrews, felt was so important to make sure that their stories were documented. So we started Beyond the Call back in 2019.
I want to follow up on what you said there, a safe place to tell the stories. I wanted to ask you about your process in working with veterans on their stories. Sometimes, as you know, vets talk to very few people, if any, about parts of their service. Tell me how you help them to open up so that this history is preserved.
I think I would say, as a filmmaker, one of the most important things before you ever pick up the camera is to build a relationship and to let your subject know that they can trust you with their story. We're not coming in just to get the gory war stories or anything. We're coming in because what they did mattered. They're the voices of the people that didn't come home, and their stories and what they did are still relevant to today. So I would say relationships are the number one thing for us. And once the cameras are put down, we stop talking about the war. We take them to lunch. We celebrate their birthdays. You know, we have fun with them and ask about the other 70 plus years of their life, get to know their wives, their kids, grandkids, and just try to make sure that we're not re-traumatizing anyone, because this is really heavy content that these people are remembering back to.
Yeah. I know Dan McBride of Silver City talks about this in the film. He wanted to share his story to help encourage all of us to avoid war at all costs.
Yes, Dan went through some of the toughest battles. He's a Purple Heart recipient. He lost many friends right beside him. And I think his hope is that they did that so we don't have to anymore, and that we can, you know, find ways to maybe at least tolerate one another's differences to avoid war. But I think after seeing so much loss, you know, Dan is one of those that just celebrates life so much and lives to the fullest. And I think he wants that for everyone, and hopes that what they did back then can be preserved and continued today.
Is this something you hear from other veterans, that part of their decision to talk about their service is connected to encouraging us to avoid war when we can?
I think it's a combination. I think obviously many of my veterans have expressed that. One of them, I'll quote him, "War is the ultimate failure of mankind. And though they feel at times it was necessary, you know, nobody wants to go to war. Nobody wants to have to fight and to lose people they loved." But I think one of the biggest drives for our veterans is in talking, especially ones that haven't talked, is they know that they're, when they go, the stories of the men and women who were killed in action or didn't come home go with them. And so they feel this duty and honor to remember the lives lost and their comrades back in battle.
Former NBC anchor Tom Brokaw famously wrote about this generation of Americans in his book, The Greatest Generation. What are your thoughts on its influence in helping raise awareness of the sacrifices and the contributions made by this great generation of people?
That's a big question to answer. There's so many thoughts and feelings when I think about this generation. Like I said, still today, the fact that I can sit here and talk with you freely, that can be traced back to the heroism and bravery of our greatest generation and what they did, you know, 75 plus years ago now. And just feeling grateful for that every day, and waking up and knowing that each day is a gift, and that the greatest generation truly, you know, they're named the greatest generation for a reason. They are just incredible. And I think that we can't go a day without recognizing that we have a lot of freedoms that were given to us because of these men and women who are still with us today, even though they may be aging and older, you know, they're still with us. And so there's still some time left to thank them.
They saved the world.
They did.
That's the bottom
line. Absolutely did.
Save the world. You know, I have a hard time getting my head around how some of this generation, people who sacrificed so much to literally save the world, how some of them must feel seeing the time that we're living in right now with the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, seeing their fellow citizens try to stop a peaceful transfer of power. I know that it's different for each individual, but I can't imagine, this must be extremely difficult for some of them.
I would say that if we look back at history and remember it, you see that goodness prevails, you know, through through so many different times in our history, goodness always prevails, and there will always be men and women that will stand up and will do the right thing. And we have evidence of that from the Greatest Generation.
Yeah, it really is important to remember that. And World War II, it's important, I think, to talk about it because of the historical context that we've already discussed, but also important in another way that I'm sure many of the people watching this right now are feeling. I know I am feeling this, that even though in my family, I don't have any relatives who are alive right now who are in the military or who are veterans. I lost one of my grandfathers in World War II and had other relatives who served in World War II. I'm sure you hear that from a lot of people, that this is extremely personal in addition to the historical context.
Absolutely. I think that whether your relative was either serving abroad or at home during World War II, everybody really was helping the war effort, whether it was at home in a factory or in the service. And so it's something that I feel like I haven't met anybody that doesn't have a connection to it in some way, shape, or form. And so it is really moving. You know, we'll be out with our veterans and we'll have families come up and just say, can my kid meet them? You know, they just recognize that they did, they saved the world, and that they, you know, want to recognize that for generations to come.
This is always a difficult question, but when you produce a film like this, what do you most want people to take away from it?
You know, I think that if you watch these films and you may not remember the names of the battles or the dates or the names of the soldiers, I want people to remember how it made them feel when they see these men and women who at the time were kids step up and do something that was so honorable and noble and helped save the world. And so I want people to go home with how they felt and take that in their daily lives. You know, how can I make a difference in my day, even if it's, you know, big or small ways, you know, just those conscious decisions of continuing that mentality and character from the Greatest Generation.
That certainly was part of how I felt. I stopped after watching this and thought about their service of others during World War II. Just got about a minute left. Final thoughts from you and what you have planned next.
We have one more coming out this year called The Monument of Tolerance, and it follows a paratrooper, a German veteran, and Holocaust survivors that have come together each year to talk about reconciliation. So that's coming out later this year that we're excited about. But I think final thoughts, I would just say when you see veterans, just say thank you for your courage and just recognize them, because you just don't know what people have gone through. You know, they're so humble, they don't talk about themselves so often. And so just take a little bit extra time to make sure that they're remembered.
Very important message. Tracy Hunter, Tracy, thank you so much for sharing this and thank you for your work. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us and for honoring Dan and all the other men and women from World War II.
And again, you can watch that documentary and the full interview tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. Former President Barack Obama dropped in on the UN climate talks this week to urge young climate activists to stay in the fight. Obama is credited as one of the leaders responsible for the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. In a speech, a roundtable, and other events Monday in Glasgow, Scotland, Obama told young people their marches and protests have been key in forcing governments to start acting on climate. We end our program this week with a portion of his address.
Even though I'm not required to attend summits like this anymore, old habits die hard. And when the issue at hand is the health of our planet and the world our children and our grandchildren will inherit, then you will have a hard time keeping me away. And that's why I'm here today, to talk about what's happened in the 6 years since I spoke to the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris, and to talk about the steps we need to take if we want to keep doing big things. Because when it comes to climate, time really is running out. You heard the same message from world leaders last week. And now that they've left, here's what we can report. Meaningful progress has been made since Paris. And the agreements made here in Glasgow, thanks to so many of you, including my friend John Kerry here, who is tireless, and his team, thanks to your efforts, here in Glasgow, we see the promise of further progress. What is also true is that collectively and individually, we are still falling short. We have not done nearly enough to address this crisis. We are going to have to do more. And whether that happens or not, to a large degree, is going to depend on you. Not just those of you in this room, but anybody who's watching or reading a transcript of what I say here today. That was true 6 years ago as well. And on Paris, our goal was to turn progress into an enduring framework that would give the world confidence in a low-carbon future. An agreement where countries would update their emissions targets on a regular basis. An agreement that would help developing nations get the resources they need to skip the dirty phase of development and help those nations that are most vulnerable to climate change get the resources they need to adapt. An agreement that would give businesses and investors the certainty that the global economy is on a firm path towards a clean and sustainable future. In other words, our hope was to create an agreement that gave our planet a fighting chance. That was our ambition. And by some measures, the agreement has been a success. For the first time, leaders of nearly 200 nations, large and small, developed and developing, made a commitment to work together to confront a threat to the people of all nations. And that seemed proof that for all the divisions in our world, when a crisis threatens all of us, we can come together to address it. At the time, we also believed that if enough national governments showed they were serious about climate, then other institutions, particularly in the private sector, would start raising their sights as well. And over the last 6 years, that is what's happened. Today, more than one-fifth of the world's largest companies have set net zero emissions targets. Not just because it's the right thing to do for the environment, but in many cases because it makes sense for their bottom line. More than 700 cities in more than 50 countries have pledged to cut their emissions in half by the end of the decade and reach net zero by 2050. About a third of the global banking sector has agreed to align their work with the Paris Agreement. So that's meaningful. Now, back in the United States, of course, some of our progress stalled when my successor decided to unilaterally pull out of the Paris Agreement in his first year in office. I wasn't real happy about that. And yet, the determination of our state and local governments, along with the regulations and investment that my administration had already put in place, allowed our country to keep moving forward, despite hostility from the White House. The $90 billion investment that we made in 2009 helped to jumpstart the clean energy industry in the United States, and markets adapted, and so did consumers. And even when the Trump administration rolled back emissions requirements for automakers, along with regulatory changes and efficiency standards, many businesses chose to stay the course. They kept reducing emissions. They continued the transition to electric vehicles and energy-saving appliances. The ball had been rolling, and it didn't stop. And meanwhile, science and technology continued to advance. So today, the price of solar and wind energy has dropped to the point where, in some places, clean energy is cheaper than fossil fuels. Around the world, scientists and entrepreneurs are integrating abundant renewable energy, more powerful batteries, breakthroughs in fields like synthetic biology to invent a better future that is healthier and more affordable. That's all good news for the planet. And it is also good news for people looking for a job. In the U.S. alone, more than 3 million people now work in clean energy-related jobs. That is more than the number of people currently employed by the entire fossil fuel industry. So despite 4 years of active hostility toward climate science coming from the very top of our federal government, the American people managed to still meet our original commitment under the Paris Agreement. And not only that, but the rest of the world stayed in the deal. And now, with President Biden and his administration rejoining the agreement, the U.S. government is once again engaged and prepared to take a leadership role. And everybody who's been watching John Kerry run around here knows that we take that role seriously. As the world's second largest emitter of greenhouse gases, the U.S. has to lead. We have enormous responsibilities. And obviously, we still have a lot of work to do. But last week, Congress passed President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure bill that will, among other things, create jobs manufacturing solar panels and wind turbines and batteries and electric vehicles and build out the first ever national network of charging stations so families can travel across the U.S. in electric vehicles. And I'm confident that a version of President Biden's Build Back Better bill will pass through Congress in the coming next few weeks. And here's what it will mean when that bill does pass. That legislation will devote over $500 billion to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by over 1 billion metric tons by the end of the decade, at least 10 times more than any legislation previously passed by Congress. Along the way, it will reduce consumer energy costs, it will invest in a clean energy economy, it will create hundreds of thousands of jobs, and it will set the United States on course to meet its new climate targets, achieving a 50 to 52% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions below 2005 levels by 2030. So the U.S. is back. And in moving more boldly, the U.S. is not alone. Earlier this year, the U.K. government, our hosts, announced a plan to cut emissions by almost 80% by 2035. This summer, the European Union put themselves on a path to carbon neutrality by 2050. Korea passed a Carbon Neutrality Act in September that requires the government to cut greenhouse gas emissions 35% or more by 2030. The Canadian government has laid out a path to carbon neutrality by 2050 with milestones to hit along the way. So, Paris showed the world that progress is possible, created a framework. Important work was done there, and important work has been done here. That is the good news. Now for the bad news. We are nowhere near where we need to be yet. For starters, despite the progress that Paris represented, most countries have failed to meet the action plans that they set 6 years ago. And the consequences of not moving fast enough are becoming more apparent all the time. Last month, a study found that 85% of the global population has experienced weather events that were more severe because of climate change. Stronger storms, longer heat waves, more intense flooding, crippling droughts. Parts of the world are becoming more dangerous to live in, triggering new migration patterns and worsening conflict around the globe. It's one of the reasons why the U.S. Pentagon and other U.S. agencies have said that climate change poses a national security threat for the U.S. and for everyone else. But not only did we not hit all of the targets that were pledged in Paris, but remember, Paris was always supposed to be a beginning, not an end point, of our joint effort to control climate change. Back in 2015, we knew that even if the commitments made as a part of the Paris Agreement were fully met, we would still fall short of our goal of keeping global temperature increases below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that's why Paris was designed to be a framework for countries to constantly ratchet up their ambitions as they got more resources and as technology reduced the cost of transitioning to a clean energy economy. So, we come now here to Glasgow. And just was as true with the Paris Agreement, there is good news and bad news about what has happened here this past week. The good news, in large part because of the efforts of the people in this room, the hours of work that you spent with, you know, weak coffee and bad food and feeling sleepy. Because of you, countries around the world are recognizing this is a decisive decade to avoid a climate disaster and are setting some really important goals for 2030. More than 100 countries this past week have committed to reduce methane emissions by 30% by 2030. As all of you know, curbing methane emissions is currently the single fastest and most effective way to limit warming. More than 100 countries have also promised to stop and reverse deforestation by the end of 2030. Businesses from around the world, name brands, some of the biggest businesses on this planet, have agreed to help create a market for the technologies we need to transition to clean energy. Here in Glasgow, nations have also committed to help poorer countries move away from fossil fuels and deal with the effects of climate change. President Biden announced that the U.S. will be quadrupling its annual climate finance pledge over the next few years to $11 billion, including $3 billion dedicated to helping vulnerable countries adapt to the impacts of climate change. And the U.S., along with 20 other countries, agreed to stop publicly financing international fossil fuel development with limited exceptions. So these are significant accomplishments. They are hard-won commitments. You should be proud of yourselves, and we need to celebrate those commitments, even as we demand that the signatories to these commitments actually follow through.
President Barack Obama speaking at the UN climate talks earlier this week. That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino, broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, KRXG Silver City.